Today, Reaping the Whirlwind, the DFA Daily to the 14th of May, 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's edition, we look at the latest employment data, CBA's views on home price falls, and the impact on the potential recovery ahead. The ABS released the April employment data today. There is no gilding the lily. 2.7 million people out of a labour force of 13.7 million people lost their jobs or had reduced hours in the last month. In March, Australians worked an average of 86 hours for every adult, whether they're in work or not. In April, that figure fell to 78 hours per adult. That's a 9% fall in a single month and the biggest ever recorded. And it takes the average number of hours worked to its lowest level on record. But with a seasonally adjusted decrease of 594,300 people employed on the ABS basis, the unemployment rate only rose 1% to 6.2%. And that's nowhere near the Great Depression level that has been recorded in the US. And the number of unemployed people increased by only 104,500, which on the surface may not sound too bad. But this is more to do with the ABS methodology and JobKeeper than anything else. Frankly, the figures are fudged. If people who worked no hours and told the ABS they were stood down had been counted as unemployed, Australia's unemployment rate in April would have been 9.3%. And if we add in other people who work 0 hours because there was not enough work available, the rate would have been 11.7%. This definition of unemployment is more consistent in the way they measure it in the US, where unemployment hit 14.7% in April, and Canada, where it hit 13%. To understand why unemployment in Australia didn't rise more, we need to get into the details of how the ABS defines unemployment. Unemployment figures don't refer to the number of people claiming government benefits. The overlap between people receiving money from Centrelink and considered by the ABS to be unemployed is surprisingly small. Australia now has 1.6 million people receiving the Job Seeker allowance, but only 823,000 considered by the ABS to be unemployed. And the ABS arrives at its figures by typically interviewing more than 50,000 Australians each month and asking them a series of questions about their work status. Like most other countries, Australia follows the measurement framework set out by the UN's International Labour Organization. In this framework, a person who is temporarily away from work, such as if they have been stood down, will still be classed as having a job if they've worked at all in the past 4 weeks, or if they've received some pay from their boss, such as through the JobKeeper program. This helps explain why 750,000 people who did not do any work in April were still considered to be employed. And once the ABS has decided that a person isn't employed, it has to decide if they are unemployed or not in the labour force. A person without a job is only considered to be unemployed if they're actively looking for work and willing and able to start work if a job becomes available. If they don't meet those criteria, they'll be considered not in the labour force. They won't count towards the unemployment rate. And the Grattan Institute flowchart gives an overview of how people are classified in the labour force statistics. Now, the ABS said the underemployment rate increased by 4.9 points to 13.7%, the highest on record, and was 5.2 points higher than in April 2019. The number of underemployed people increased by 603,000 in April 2020 to 1.6 million people. And that's an increase of almost 50% and increased by 66,100 people since April 2019. The underutilization rate increased by 5.9 points to 19.9%. And the participation rate decreased 2.4 points to 63.5%. And the employment to population ratio decreased 2.9 points to 59.6. That 594,300 people, or down 4.6% between March and April, included full-time employment decreasing by 220,500 people and part-time employment decreasing by 373,800 people, and monthly hours worked in all jobs decreased by 163.9 million hours, down 9.2%, to 1.6 trillion hours in April 2020. And that's larger than the decrease in employed people. And in April 2020, the average hours worked per employed person was around 30.1 hours per week, down from around 32 hours in March. And all the states and territories recorded decreases in employment. The largest decreases in employment were recorded in New South Wales, down 291,400 people. Queensland, down 129,600 people. Victoria, down 127,100 people. Western Australia, down 62,300 people. And South Australia, down 40,800 people. Unemployment rates increased in all states and territories. The largest increases were 1.3 points in Tasmania, up 6.2%, 1.2 points in Queensland, up to 6.8%, and 1.1 points in New South Wales, up to 6%. The largest participation rate decreases were 2.8 points in both New South Wales, down to 62.6%, and Western Australia, down to 65.2%, followed by 2.6 points in Queensland, down to 62.9%, and by 2.5 points in South Australia, down to 60.4%. And finally, people of all ages were more likely to be unemployed or underemployed in April than in March, but COVID-19 continues to hit younger people hardest. Youth unemployment rose to 13.8% in April, or double the headline unemployment rate, with more than 20% of Australians aged 15 to 24 also underemployed. More than one third of younger Australians are without paid work or working fewer hours than they would like to. In contrast, unemployment among Australians aged 45 plus barely moved between March and April. Now, the shock to the labour market is not unexpected. Governments have quite sensibly closed down whole swathes of the economy to limit the spread of the virus, but the size of the hit to its jobs is still breathtaking. And it's disguised by the unemployment rate. Australia's labour market won't be in a healthy state again until the number of hours worked per person climbs back to its pre-crisis levels and underemployment falls to merely bad rather than horrific levels, and that could take years. And earlier in the week, we got a glimpse of the path ahead. Treasury said that improved demand, including in the retail sector and the reopening of schools, might be the largest contributors to an estimated $9.4 billion monthly rise in GDP from the planned three-stage lifting of COVID restrictions. The first stage of easing, which the states are now implementing at varying paces, will increase monthly GDP by an estimated $3.1 billion. Of this, $0.97 billion is estimated to come from stronger demand and $0.73 billion from reopening schools. Easing of first-stage restrictions is also set to see jobs increase by 252,500, with the second and third stage easing boosting employment by 275,100 and 323,200, respectively. The government said it aims for a COVID-safe economy by July. And Treasurer Josh Frydenberg's economic update to Parliament on Tuesday did not give a forecast for the massive deficit the October budget will contain. Remember that only a few months ago, Frydenberg expected to deliver a surplus, which would have been brought in this week, but of course has now been cancelled. Modelling assumes that as people start to hit the shops, the largest single increase in monthly GDP from the three-stage easing is $2.9 billion, and that's expected to come from improved demand. This is followed by $2.18 billion from schools opening, which allows more parents to return to work. The big number is one reason why Scott Morrison has been so strong on the need for schools to return to normal. But first, household finances are being severely damaged, as our updated stress data released yesterday showed. And Deputy Chief Medical Officer Paul Kelly told The Conversation on Monday that there is a large risk of a second wave. If a second wave developed, there was the option of reintroducing some restrictions, though that could be in a very measured and localised way to deal with the outbreaks, even if they were large. And the emerging debate, as both sides of politics look to the other side of the crisis, will be how big a role the government needs to play directly in the recovery. Asked on Monday whether, in light of the success of containing the virus, the Treasury's scheduled review into JobKeeper would assess whether to truncate or alter the programme before its September expiry, Morrison said, "All of this is very premature. We are 6 weeks into a six-month programme. And the impact of the virus, how it will impact on Australia in the months ahead with a reopening economy, is very much a work in progress. That's why we've put this six-month lifeline in place." And Morrison also said how that programme can be adjusted to better support over that period, or if there are sectors that come under greater strain over a longer period of time. These are all things that the government is fully aware of, but we're not going to get ahead of ourselves. And Frydenberg highlighted sobering data in the economy. In March, business and consumer confidence saw the largest declines on record. The ASX lost a third of its value in just 4 weeks. In April, surveys showed that job ads halved, and activity in the construction, manufacturing and services sector had their largest ever monthly falls. New motor vehicle sales fell by 48%, their largest ever fall, and house sales by 40%. And as part of the government's response, over $25 billion of support has already flowed to households and businesses in recent weeks, with more than $30 billion to flow next month. And Treasury estimates that easing restrictions on cafes, restaurants, pubs and clubs will boost monthly GDP by $1.75 billion over the three steps. But the third stage boost of $0.5 billion reflects the slowness of the easing in this sector. Domestic and international travel contributes only 0.72 billion increase in monthly GDP over the three stages, reflecting the closure of the international border for the foreseeable future, as well as limitations on domestic travel and the depressed economy. With restrictions eased, New South Wales would contribute $3.1 billion increase in monthly GDP over the three steps, and Victoria, $2.2 billion. For the first stage, the figures for New South Wales and Victoria are $1 billion and $707 million, respectively. Australia's budget deficit will blow out to 7.2% of gross domestic product this fiscal year, and in the 12 months through to June 2021, as revenue collapses and spending soars in response to a virus-induced economic shutdown, said Deloitte Access Economics. The budget is taking a series of staggering blows, Chris Richardson, a Deloitte partner, said in a report released earlier in the week. Fewer workers and lower incomes means personal taxes take the biggest hit compared with official forecasts. Relative to the mid-year economic and fiscal outlook released in December, revenues are set to fall short by 6% in 2019-20 and then 16% in 2021. Profits will take a pounding as well, meaning corporate taxes look set to fall well shy of official forecasts. the government and central bank put together a fiscal monetary package worth 16.4% of GDP to help nurse households and firms through the crisis. And authorities planned to reopen the crippled economy by July and aim to get 850,000 people back in jobs as their success in flattening the curve of the virus infections allows a relaxation of lockdown restrictions. Even with the amazing success Australia is achieving in the fight against the virus, the oldest problem in economics is that unemployment goes down much slower than it goes up, Richardson said. So our nation will begin its recovery with unemployment high, the private sector scared, the Reserve Bank tapped out, and prices for our key exports weak. That says Australia's recovery will be strikingly dependent on the extent to which our governments, federal and state, switch their policies away from the virus sprint and towards the recovery marathon. Australia has recorded its largest ever drop in overseas travel, with visitor arrivals falling 60% in March 2020 compared to a year earlier, according to data released by the ABS. The ABS said there was also a record fall in the number of Australian residents returning from short-term trips overseas, down 29% to 538,400. These large decreases reflect the travel restriction progressively put in place by the Australian government from the beginning of February due to the COVID outbreak. In March 2020, there were 331,900 visitors who had arrived for a short-term trip, compared to 836,300 12 months earlier. The steep fall in visitor arrivals to Australia in March was from all regions around the world. Even our largest source country, New Zealand, recorded a 56% drop. Of the top 10 source countries, China recorded the largest decrease of 78%, followed closely by Japan, with a decrease of 75%. And all states and territories recorded large falls in international visitors, although New South Wales led the way with the largest volume of international arrivals, 114,500 visitors. Numbers were down 64% compared to 1 year earlier. The Northern Territory saw the largest fall, down 66%. Queensland also saw a steep decline in visitors, down 63%, followed by Victoria, down 58%, South Australia, down 54%, Western Australia, down 53%, Tasmania, down 51%, and the ACT, down 43%. And banks continue to take a hit. CBA's third quarter update followed the same path as its peers, with higher provisions, higher defaults, and margin pressure. But the killer slide was one on home price expectations. In the base case, prices are expected to fall on average by 11%, but their more severe case is a fall of 32% over the next 2 years. This is actually closer to our scenarios, as we discussed in our last live stream. The evidence is mounting that as household finances continue to deteriorate, this will indeed translate to price falls. Already, lenders are tightening their lending rules. For example, from the 17th of May, Westpac will cease accepting loan applications from a swathe of potential borrowers, including small business owners and independent tradespeople, who want to fund 80% or more of a residential property purchase through credit. The new restrictive policy will also apply to all loans assessed for borrowers who generate income from a mix of independent business activity and pay-as-you-go employment, as other businesses. Westpac has extended some leeway to doctors and other health professionals under the new policy. Medical practitioners can secure finance on a loan to value ratio of up to 85%. And Westpac and its regional banking brands, St George, Bank of Melbourne and Bank SA, are also reining in lending to borrowers in suburban and regional areas most affected by the sudden collapse in tourism activity caused by the COVID lockdown measures. Borrowers in tourism hotspots such as Port Douglas in Queensland and Byron Bay in New South Wales are now required to stump up deposits of at least 30% of the value of a residential property to be eligible for a home loan. However, the wording of the memo to brokers has stoked conjecture that Westpac's ultra-cautious approach was triggered by moves from reinsurers to withdraw from covering the default risks of home borrowers with small deposits. Westpac self-insures its mortgage default risk through a captive vehicle, but farms out its lender's mortgage insurance exposure to a panel of reinsurers, which includes the Bermudian-based Arch Capital Group. Arch's profitability is under pressure after it reported a 31% slide in after-tax profit for the March quarter to $133 million. And we also noted that Genworth took a downgrade from another ratings agencies today. And this is, I think, a sign of the times. And finally, across the ditch, the New Zealand Monetary Policy Committee in New Zealand has agreed to significantly expand the large-scale asset purchase, the LSAP program potential, to $60 billion, up from the previous $33 billion limit. The LSAP program includes New Zealand government bonds, local government funding, agency bonds, and now New Zealand government inflation index bonds. The global economic disruption caused by COVID-19 is expected to persist and lead to lower economic growth, employment and inflation both in New Zealand and abroad, even if New Zealand successfully contains the spread of disease locally. Reduced world activity will mean lower demand for many of New Zealand's exports. The Monetary Policy Committee is committed, it says, to achieving its employment and inflation objectives. The main support for the economy in this environment is appropriately being provided through increased fiscal spending. However, monetary policy still continues to provide significant support through keeping interest rates low for the foreseeable future. The balance of economic risks remain on the downside, they said, and the expansion to the LSAP program aims to continue to reduce the cost of borrowing quickly and sharply. This is preferable to delivering a small amount of stimulus now, only to risk later realizing more should have been done. They expect to see retail interest rates decline further as lower wholesale borrowing costs are passed through to retail customers, and it remains in the best long-term interests of the banking sector to promptly maximise the effectiveness of this LSAP programme, they said. The official cash rate is being held at 0.25% in accordance with the guidance that they issued on the 16th of March. And the Monetary Policy Committee is prepared to use additional monetary policy tools if and when needed, including reducing the OCR further, adding other types of assets to the LSAP program, and providing fixed-term loans to banks. The committee's decisions are guided by the Reserve Bank's mandate and their decision-making principles on the use of alternative monetary policy instruments. So I have to say, standing back, it does appear that the economic fallout from the lockdown is going to hang around for a long time, despite the best endeavours of central banks. It is likely to mean higher unemployment for at least a couple of years, and the likelihood of property price falls, negative equity, and ultimately forced sales are going to rise. So there is very little good news in the midst of all this data. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.